STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my friends. So glad to have you on board today for our show. Stand to Reason is the name of the show, and I'm your host, Greg Kokel, with you every week for at least 2 hours of Clear Thinking Christianity. And there's another half hour, actually, of another podcast called Hashtag STR Ask. We run it a little differently. We don't take live calls. You send your questions in to Hashtag STR Ask, and then we use that. And the Enforcer and I do that show together, and that's a bit different. It's been a lot of fun, though. How long have we been doing STR Ask now? It's 4 months now? Really? Wow. Okay, so different ways that we try to make interaction available for you. This show, of course, call in for the most part. I talk, but I also take your calls. The number is 855-243-9975. The live show is on Tuesday nights from 4 until 6 Los Angeles time, and that's when you can call and chat with me. And I look forward to getting to some callers already on board here. I did want to talk about something somewhat personal here. You may be, well, I think it's appropriate, and it may interest you too. And that is personal in the sense that my mom passed away about a month ago now. It was the 6th of December. And I've had a lot of chance to think about her and the circumstances. I lost my dad about 11 years before that. He went first. Melinda said that when you lose your first parent, it's like a comma. When you lose your second parent, it's like a period. there's a certain finality to that kind of thing. My own reflections, though, have been a bit different. I will say quite surprisingly to me, I have thought about my mom more in the last month than I have collectively in the years before that, though I called her on a fairly regular basis. And the cabin that you know, many of you know, that the summer place that I and my girls and my wife go up to in the summer and to do some fishing in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, this is was my mom's. She had inherited it from her dad, and now it passes to me, as it turns out. Now I'm going to kind of take care of it for the rest of the family. But that was her place, and so I talked to her about that. But it's just been something about the finality of death caused me to be more pensive about her life. She was 86 when she died. She was born in 1929, which is the year the stock market crashed. Which means that in her case, everything that she remembers about her childhood, or she remembered about her childhood, was up against the backdrop of the Great Depression. Now, her father, who is my grandfather, Arthur Converse, who, by the way, had a great-great uncle, I think I got the numbers of greats there right around the time of the Civil War. Maybe it needs another great. My grandfather was born right at the turn of the century. Anyway, his great-great or great-great-great uncle was Charles Converse, who, as it turned out, wrote the music to What a Friend We Have in Jesus. I didn't know that until I had become a Christian, and then my mom told me, and then I did some research and learned that was true. But that was kind of interesting to find out. But my grandfather was a lumberjack in northern Wisconsin. As a young man in the early 20th century, and because he wanted, though he lived most of his life in Chicago, he wanted to retire in Wisconsin. So he bought that property in 1960 that he built a small place on. We call it the cabin. My concerns are whenever I mention that word, it conjures up images that are nothing like our cabin. It's a very humble place, let's put it that way. But in any event, that's how that property came to be, and been going up there ever since, and as a kid, spending a portion of the summer, a few times, even the whole summer, up there adventuring with my own brothers and other siblings. But I don't actually know what my grandpa did for a living when my mom was born. I know later he became an agent for the Prudential Insurance Company, and that's how he retired. But I do know that they lived in the projects in Chicago, and that means they were poor. My mom, when she was probably about 17, met my dad at a roller skating. She was an only child. She met my dad at a roller skating rink at Riverview. Now, Riverview is not a word that will mean anything to most of you, but I'll just let you know that Riverview was the number one theme park of the time, and had incredible roller coasters, and it's not there anymore. They tore it down in 1969, I think. But we used to go as kids, and it was really something, you know. It was kind of like the Disneyland of the day. Although Disneyland, I guess, started in the early 50s, but that was Southern California, not in Chicago. Anyway, they had a roller rink there, and sometime mid-40s, my mom and dad met there at that roller rink, and by 18, they were married. And when my mom was 19, she had my sister Sue. When she was 20, she had me, 1950. She had Mark when she was 23. She had David when she was 50. She was had just turned 25. And at the time, in the first 5 years of her lives, we lived on a farm in kind of central Wisconsin, Antigo area, a potato farming country. My dad wasn't a potato farmer. All his buddies were. He had some cattle, some dairy cows, but he worked at a fertilizer factory in town. That's how he made a living, and it wasn't much. His old clapboard house that had a windmill running the pump. We had an outhouse, two-story farmhouse, which in Good Friday of 1954 burned right to the ground. We just barely got out by the skin of our teeth and went to the neighbors. The Harley farm, I think they were, and they took us in, and we watched the barn go all the house go all the way down. We stayed in the garage for a couple more months. Then my dad filed bankruptcy. We moved to Chicago, and that's when mom and dad had number five, my sister Bonnie, and mom was 27. She got five kids. She's 27. All right, and she was finished. And I mean it. She was done with having kids, and we were not an easy brood to raise. Okay, I have one vivid memory. I have many memories from early on in Chicago, those first few years when I was in first and second and third grade. But the thing that stands out is my mom sitting in the kitchen, pulling at her hair and screaming because we were driving her crazy. A rough brood, like I said. Of course, we all felt bad for her, and we said, "Oh, Mom, please don't. I'm sorry. We're sorry." It was hard. Now, this reflection here is not really meant to be a eulogy of Mom, as much to emphasize a reality of life that we're all kind of aware of, but we forget about, I think, most of the time, until some event drives it into our immediate awareness. And that is the irretrievable loss of the present into the past. Every time somebody dies that's close to you, you lose them. You don't just lose them, you lose everything that they can contribute in terms of memories and background and history and the like. I mentioned to you in the past how my now 11-year-old Annabeth, when she was about 8 or 9, was moping about, despondent, and I'd asked her, why are you sad, honey? And she just said, quite frankly, "I am mourning the loss of my childhood." That is, she was, even at that age, aware that time passes and you move from one stage to another, and the stage you leave gets lost in the past forever. Never to be retrieved. Right after Mom died, we were looking for videos that I had taken that were on my computer. And there were some clips that I had taken of my girls when they were much younger. And there they were, you know, no teeth, little bitty things, toddling around, barely speaking English. They were cute. You know how it is. You see these things. But you know what? I there was one set of videos. We had some farm, and they were petting animals or whatever. And I was frustrated with the video because I was taking a video of what they were doing. And what I really wanted to do at that point was to see them. I wanted to see their faces. I wanted to remember the way they were just a few years ago. And those days are gone. Now, they're still young, 11 and 8, and I'm taking more videos now to capture what they look like now, because 5 years from now, I'm going to be thinking back on this time and thinking, gee, I wish I had those moments back again. No, we lose those moments, and they're gone. And this was really the point of an observation another friend of mine made, and what she said is, when your parents are gone, you are now the last generation. And that's really true. I was thinking about my mom and the projects. I wonder what that was like. She used to talk about it a little bit, but not a whole lot. And if I had any questions about what it was like to live in the projects in Chicago in the 30s, I can't ask my mom anymore because she's gone. In fact, all the personal memories of that time are gone in terms of my personal access. And if I want to know anything about my mom's past or my dad's past or any of my ancestors' past or of my past, what was I like when I was a little tyke on the farm, those early years? There's no one to tell me. My mom is gone. My dad is gone. My grandparents are gone. My aunts and uncles are gone. They're all gone. The grass withers. The flower fades. I guess it was a bit sobering thinking about that. You know, we all think different things when we lose someone close to us. Of course, we're aware of the loss. But sometimes there are these other thoughts, too. The loss of the person. But it's not just the loss of the person. Other things are lost as well. The past is lost, for all intents and purposes. Unless you've captured it in some way through that person's writing, or recollections that you've recorded, or videos of them that you've taken. But whatever you haven't done is not going to get done once they're gone. And, I was thinking, even in my own times, you know, numbering my own days and making my own days mean more or work more or be more meaningful or productive. I told my girls, one day I'll be gone. And whatever you have left of me will be what you remember of me now. And I want those remembrances to be good ones. We all have bad remembrances of our childhood, because none of us had perfect parents, and I'm far from that myself. But when I think about what will they reflect on, I don't want them to think about an angry or graceless or crabby dad, or a person who lived inconsistently with his profession. Claimed to be a Christian, but gee, there were lots of stuff in his life that were nothing like being a real Christian, a follower of Christ. I don't want them to think that. I want them to have positive images of me when they think back. And, you know, I'm an old dad. I'm 65. I got an 8 and an 11. Okay? So much of their adult life, you know, I'm not going to witness. I'm going to be gone before they get very far into adulthood, probably. And that will give them a lot of time to be thinking back, and I just want to make those remembrances good ones. And I don't necessarily mean like, oh yeah, Dad took us to Disneyland. No, I want them to think about the good things I gave them that meant something. A heritage I passed on, a virtue I worked to instill in them, a way that I was that they have fond memories of. I want them, as one person put it, to remember me laughing, not yelling. And so how do you do that? Well, you just laugh more. You laugh more. You give them good things to remember. And I want them more than anything else to remember that spiritual substance that I spent time investing in their lives, that I intentionally passed on to them. And that's the kind of thing that matters most. Anyway, so Mom, we miss you. And thank you for what you gave us. And may I give well to my own children. All right, time for your calls and comments coming up here. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason.
Are you a student with hard questions about God, Jesus, or the Bible? Or do you have a student in your life who is asking questions that you aren't prepared to answer? Then it's time to pay a visit to the student resources page at strnextgen.com, where you'll find tons of fresh and compelling information for students, parents, and youth leaders. It's a rich collection of articles and videos, including responses to common objections about the Christian faith. And there's even a place where you can invite me, Brett Kunkel, to speak at your local school or church. So head over to the student resources page today. Just visit strnextgen.com.
If you lack the time to wade through thick volumes to get a solid grasp of tough topics, STR has a short and sweet solution. Our Ambassador's Guides are quick reads that give you easily digestible answers to crucial concerns you face as a Christian ambassador. Each volume in this series equips you with the information and outlook you need to understand an issue confronting Christians today. When you visit the STR store at str.org, you'll find a library of ambassador's guides, including guides to Mormonism, Islam, postmodernism, the New Atheists, pluralism, understanding homosexuality, and the voice of God. To order copies and become a better equipped and more knowledgeable ambassador, visit the online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON. That's 800-273-2766.
Friday, folks. Time for your calls here at Stand to Reason. And let's see. We got Michael in Olympia, Washington. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Greg. Am I on?
Yes, you are. Welcome to the show, Mike.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
So I had a question about definition of faith. Not necessarily. I don't know. I just wanted your thoughts on it because,
okay.
Well, I'll just fill you in a little bit on the background. I'm a student at a university, a Catholic university up here in Washington.
Uh-huh.
And basically they have four core themes, which are faith, reason, service, and community, which they kind of build their, well, they try to build their academics around.
Uh-huh.
And I don't really have a problem with that, but, well, this year, what they want to do is every year is, you know, reassess each one, you know, get people's input, which I think is good,
mm-hmm.
For each of those themes. And this year we're discussing faith. Mm-hmm. And so I went to I got invited to like a faculty talk, so I'm in like kind of a position to, put this forward a little bit more, or to have my opinion, you know, heard a little bit more.
Sure. Yeah. Great.
So I went to that, and they had the presentation, and then the definition that they came up with, or that they've used for the past few years. Now, I'm going to read it to you right now, and hopefully you can,
okay.
can have your thoughts on that. So, It's faith is the commitment we have to the exploration of our beliefs. We acknowledge the fundamental necessity of the human confrontation with faith in all its aspects, religious, interpersonal, political, social, and all the commitments required in life as a critical element in the pursuit of truth. So that's it right there.
I wrote some of that down, but my first reaction is they're trying way too hard. They made something, I think, that is more simple to be almost so complicated, it's hard to know what target you're shooting at here based on what they've just said. What was the last line? Is a critical aspect of...
Yeah, it was just
search
kind of
for
a,
truth? Search
for thing, as a critical element in the pursuit of truth.
Element in the pursuit of truth. Well, okay. If I were doing it, I would approach it a little differently. And I think what they're trying to do is to foster a kind of broad communication about one's own faith and the ramifications of one's own faith commitment on all of these other areas of life. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so I think, well, that's good. If what they mean is that our worldview as Christians ought to speak to these areas, fine, I'm in that. I'm with you on that. But I think before you can speak to those areas, you have to have a crisper definition of a couple of things that pertain to faith. Faith generally has one of two general uses. One is one's act of faith. So you say, I have faith in Jesus, or I have faith in the Bible. So there's an act of faith. And then then we have our faith tradition. So my faith is Christian, or someone else's faith might be Hindu or whatever. So we're using these words in a different way. The biggest problem right now is this definition of the act of faith, okay? We have a faith tradition. We have a tradition that claims certain things are true about the world. God and salvation and Jesus and all kinds of things fall under that. Not only theological things, but historical things. For example, the resurrection happening in history and Jesus walking this earth in his history. And also moral things about certain things that are right and certain things are wrong. So this is the content of our conviction. When we act as if the content of our convictions is actually true, those are acts of faith.
Okay.
And our acting out our faith is the part where there's the most confusion, I think. I noticed that they put faith and reason as two different categories. I'm curious how they distinguish faith and reason.
I think they try to integrate all of them. I'm not sure they're trying to make a separation between them.
They may not be making a separation, but it's not always clear, especially in this period of time. Now, if you're going to a Catholic institution, you probably have some Jesuits that are involved in the training. And Jesuits have characteristically been very vigorous in terms of their use of reason in the prosecution of their beliefs or their convictions about faith. There's a good integration there. But nowadays, it's hard to know because things have been so relativized. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe something that might be helpful is unlike this kind of inclusivistic kind of theology that you talk about sometimes on the show. Mm-hmm. That pretty much describes what is kind of the ideas going on, theologically, in the religious studies department and stuff, and like the monastery.
Right. Right. Well, in this particular case, the inclusivism coming from the Roman Catholic Church is the idea that yes, Jesus is necessary for salvation, but that doesn't mean you have to believe in him. This, to me, is a radical departure from what the Scripture teaches and what the apostles taught and what Jesus taught. I mean, just for the record, and you already know this because you've heard me talk about this before, but this is something that you're going to be running into. And so I'm trying to think about where you can make your best contribution here. And it seems like the target is not really clear. It's kind of all over the map. I'd want to distinguish what do Christians, well, let me back up and put it this way, instead of what do Christians, but what does the Bible refer to when it is asking about an act of faith? What is it referring to? And the simplest answer there is that faith, biblically, is active trust. But it is a trust that is earned. And so this is why when you go, for example, to, by the way, notice the contrast. We think of a faith generally as a leap. Well, faith is what you believe. You don't have reasons for that. You can't know that. Otherwise, there's no room for faith. So, you know, you just take a leap and hope you're right kind of thing. But this is, the Bible knows nothing of this approach. And when you think of the Gospel of John, you go to the very end of the Gospel of John, chapter 20, and John himself talks about why he wrote the most famous account of Jesus' life that's ever been written. And he says, he makes reference to the signs Jesus performed. And he said there were lots of them. Now, a sign is a miracle, all right, an attesting miracle, more specifically. It's an attesting miracle, that it is a miracle that attests to something else. The miracle is cool by itself, but it also attests to something else. Remember Jesus when the paralytic was lowered through the ceiling? And Jesus said, your sins are forgiven. And people said, how could you forgive sins? And then he says this, in order that you may know that the Son of Man has the authority to forgive sins, I say to you, arise, take up your pallet, and go home. So here, his miracle of healing the paralytic was attesting to the truth of his ability to forgive sins. You can't see the forgiveness of sins, but you can see the miracle. And so the miracle that you can see attests to the spiritual realities that you cannot see. So the first proves the second. That's what...
Right, yeah.
Okay, that's what John
is
what John is talking about here at the end of... And let me just finish the thought here and I'll let you jump in. At the end of John then, John chapter 20, verse 30 and 31, he says, many other attesting miracles, like we just talked about, Jesus performed in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these, the ones that he has included, and there's a lot of miracles in the Gospel of John, these have been written, included in this account, so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Now, here's what I want to underscore for your conversations with your friends. John says the reason that he wrote his gospel is to give evidences that demonstrate that Jesus is who he claimed to be. So you can put an intelligent trust, confidence, faith, if you will, in Jesus for your salvation. The biblical record is faith is not a leap of it's actually a step of trust based on evidence. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's that drives home right here. Like at the very end, it says there's a critical element in the pursuit of truth. I guess that's they're reversing the order. Like faith, you have your faith, and then you go and pursue truth rather than letting the truth inform your faith. I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Truth comes first. Faith is second. Faith is not a way of knowing. And see, the way they put it there, it sounds suspiciously like it is your faith that makes the religious claims true for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't the biblical order. The claims are either are true or false, and we know they're true because they're good reason to believe they're true, and that's the evidence that John is talking about there, the attesting miracles. And so now that we have good reason to believe that Jesus is who he claimed to be, now it's up to us to act on that by putting our trust in him. And by the way, if the reason he wrote the Gospel of John is so that we would believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and in believing have life, then if you do not believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, then you don't have the life that believing in him gets you.
Right.
Which means their inclusivism is false. There is no such thing as implicit faith in Christ. That Jews, well, they're really believing in Jesus even though they don't know about Jesus. There is no such thing. Hindus don't have implicit faith in Christ by worshiping idols. They are disobeying God by breaking the first commandment. And the same with Buddhists and everybody else who's pursuing, you know, their faith tradition as best as they know how. It may be the as best as they know how, but it's false. And they are deceived by the deceiver. And they are going to suffer as a result of being deceived. And see, this is something that I don't think the Roman Church wants to kind of stand up to or to step up to. And that is the reality of the deception in the world that other religions are false ways of characterizing God, and therefore they're false religions, God and salvation. And therefore, taken as a whole, they are false religions. And if they are false religions, then they are not going to get people to God. So this is what you're up against there. I've actually written on this a two-part piece called No Other Name. I think it's available on our website because it was a solid ground that I wrote a number of years ago. And
okay, maybe we'll check that out.
Yeah, yeah. The first part is meant to deal with religious pluralism, just a broad-based all religions lead to God, and that's just false. And it's not because I'm bigoted. It's just simple math. Everybody can't be right. They believe opposite things. But there is a variation of that called inclusivism. That's what you mentioned earlier, and that's the idea that all religions themselves aren't true in themselves, but they're good enough to get you to Jesus, even if you don't believe in Jesus. And that's the Roman Catholic view. And I just saw a thing that came out. I didn't bring it in to talk about it today because I want to read the underlying document that this article was reporting on. But the headline says that basically, the Vatican is saying, or it's a commission of the Roman Catholic Church that has some authority, is saying that there's no need to evangelize Jews anymore. They don't need it. Now, I actually heard this over 25 years ago in interfaith discussions with Roman Catholic priests on radio. I was stunned to hear it since I was raised a Catholic. But now, you know, they're saying more explicitly than ever, you don't need to witness to Jews. Why not? Well, they have their own way of salvation. Really, what is that? I thought Jesus was the only way of salvation. Yeah, 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 but you don't need to believe in Jesus in order to benefit from Jesus. That's their view. Okay, so...
Yeah, that's kind of interesting because, I don't know, just going in, like, last year, I went in kind of, you know, ignorant to this, you know, these whole, you know, different systems of thought, you know, regarding salvation like that.
Yeah.
And so I encountered this kind of inclusivistic attitude.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of like, you know, I didn't know what to make of it at first, and then I heard, I didn't know where they were getting what they were getting, so then I, you know, and then eventually I, you know, heard, started listening to your show more, and then, you know, you described it like to the T, and it was, I don't know, and I guess, I don't know, the way I look at it, it's kind of like, you know, superficially, it's like, you know, a kind of philosophy that, you know, kind of is coherent for somewhat. But then, you know, if you just kind of, but it's not one that can, you know, coexist with what is in Scripture, I guess.
Yes, that's the key. I think it's entirely coherent. It makes all the sense in the world if you say you don't have to believe in Jesus in order to be saved by Jesus. You can believe in something else, and God honors that as faith in Jesus. That makes perfect sense. I just don't think it's true. And the only way we know it's true is going back to the text, and the text teaches this nowhere, period. And in fact, and I might... Let me offer you a couple of thoughts quickly before I have to go to arm you just a little bit with some passages. And you will find some of these in the article if you read the article. But in Acts chapter 4, Peter goes before the Sanhedrin. Now, this is the Jewish council, the Jewish tribunal. These are the Jewish leaders, the rabbis of the time, if you will. And he says there is salvation in none other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. And he doesn't say, and by the way, you can just ignore what I've said because you are really good Jews doing the best you can following Judaism, so you're already in. No need for you to whip me again for saying what I said because I'm acknowledging that you are really in. No worries. Now, why had they whipped? Why did the Jewish leadership scourge Peter? It's because he was declaring Jesus, the resurrection, and the necessity of faith in Jesus. Look at his opening sermon there in Acts chapter 2. There is no way you can take Peter's words in Acts 2 or 4 and make them conform to this inclusivistic gospel. There just is no possible way. But it's worse than that. Because you can also go further in the book of Acts to chapter 10, and this is where Peter, again, is called in a vision by God to go speak to Cornelius, who is a God-fearer. Now, a God-fearer is the kind of guy who's doing the best he can under the circumstances to follow God by the light he's been given. And so he's a Gentile, he's not in the assembly of the Jews, but he's doing the best that he can, right? And an angel appears to Cornelius, and then an angel appears to Peter and brokers a meeting, right? That's what it's about. Mm-hmm. And here in verse 34 of Acts 10, when Peter finally goes to see Cornelius, he's a little reluctant because this guy, after all, is a Gentile. By the way, let me just, here's the way the text describes Cornelius, chapter 10, verse 1. Now, there was a man at Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian cohort, a devout man, one who has feared God with all his household, has given many alms to the Jewish people, and prayed to God continually. And then, in virtue of all this godliness, has a vision from an angel. Wow. He's in. Right? He's the guy. He's doing everything that the inclusivists say. And then Peter goes and visits him and says, verse 34, I most certainly understand now that God is not one to show partiality, but in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him. Wow, end of issue. Peter gets up and he leaves. No, he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
What he just gave was the inclusivist gospel of the Roman Catholic Church. But Peter knew that Cornelius still wasn't saved. He needed the gospel, which he then gives him, and which he preaches in a powerful way there. And it's interesting that what he says to Cornelius in verse 42 is that this is a message that he, Jesus, ordered us to preach to the people. Well, how is it if Jesus orders them to preach to the people that some church official here in the Roman Catholic Church is ordering their people not to preach it?
Mm-hmm.
So I encourage you to read Acts chapter 10 because I think this passage all by itself proves that the inclusivist message is just flat out false, because if it were true, Cornelius would already be saved. So go ahead.
Okay. One final question on your way out, just regarding that. Could they possibly, respond to that, saying, okay, well, this, these commands are for, just these apostles or these 12, but not, for the church as a whole, I guess. I don't know.
Well, first of all, this wasn't in the case of Peter in his Acts 4 circumstance. He was preaching the full message to the people who needed. He was preaching to Jewish people who were following their own ways and needed to be corrected. Okay. Now, if you want to focus in on verse 42 of chapter 10, and he ordered us to preach to the people. solemnly to testify that this is the one who has been appointed by God as judge of the living and the dead, and that was just for the 12 apostles, then what is the point of the Catholic, any church moving on after that with any message about Jesus and the gospel? Yeah. I mean, that pretty much undermines the whole enterprise if they're going to say this is just for them. Notice what Paul said to when he's about ready to move on in his martyrdom, and this is in 2 Timothy chapter 1. He says to Timothy, now this is Paul about to die. He says, retain the standard of sound words which you heard from me in the faith and love which are in Christ Jesus. Guard through the Holy Spirit who dwells in us the treasure which has been entrusted to you. What treasure is that? What he's just been talking about. I am not ashamed of the testimony of our Lord.
Mm-hmm.
He is entrusting Timothy with the gospel that is to be preached. So this is passed down generation after generation. This isn't a command just for Peter. This is a command to bring salvation to the world. Go into all the world and make disciples. And that entails preaching this gospel. So if you get that copy of that article, that I have all kinds of passages in there that will help in this regard. This doctrine of inclusivism, nobody even hinted at such a thing for the first 1,000 years of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we introducing something that is contrary to the direct commands of Jesus and the direct commands of the apostles? As if
it's a nice
holy
thought, I guess.
Yeah, it's a nice thought. It's just a false thought. It's a deception. And there are a whole lot of people giving false hope. Okay, that's great, Mike. It's very good to talk with you. I'm glad we had this extended conversation, okay? I'd be interested to hear.
Thanks, Greg. Yeah.
I'd be interested to hear.
Maybe I'll get back to you on this. But.
Yeah, do that. Get back with me and let me know how it goes. All right. Got to run to break, and we'll have your final callers when I return on Stand to Reason.
Would you like to know the one unifying theme of the entire Bible? Greg Kokel reveals it to you in The Bible Fast Forward, his sweeping 8-lesson series on DVD. Greg demonstrates, from Genesis to Revelation, that the Bible represents one cohesive plan of salvation. This fascinating tour of Scripture shows you how the events, covenants, and promises of the Old Testament come to their perfect focus and fulfillment in Jesus Christ. This masterful survey of God's redemptive plan is available to you on DVD or on demand via HD streaming or download. It also includes a comprehensive 145-page study outline with questions for reflection or group discussion. To order the Bible Fast Forward, visit STR's online store at store.str.org or call 800-2-REASON today.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, Instagram, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org. Click Get Connected at the top of the page.
Greg Kokel back at you here at Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind as I do every week on our two-hour show. You can call in 855-243-9975. Quick note, coming up August 6th through 13th, our Alaska cruise. I love these things. We have such a fabulous time. This will be our third time going to Alaska on a conference cruise. We'll be departing from Seattle, be heading to Juneau, Alaska, also Sitka. Also, Ketchikan. We'll spend some time in Victoria, B.C., so we'll be in Canada. Our training will be provided by J. Warner Wallace from Cold Case Christianity, John Stone Street from the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview, and yours truly representing Stand to Reason. We're all going to be there, not just for the training, but for the whole cruise, which means we're available and off time to hang out, to chat, to enjoy each other's company, have breakfast together, have meals together. Plenty of teaching, plenty of fellowship, plenty of fabulous scenery, and plenty of time to enjoy it. Get the information at Inspiration Cruises, 800-247-1899, or you can just go to inspirationcruises.com/STR. All right, let's go to Jonathan in Camarillo, California, which is just down the hill from my home. Hello,
yeah,
Jonathan.
I know.
Yes.
Greg, hi. Good to talk to you. I don't know if you remember us, but you could have come speak to us at our church on February the 7th.
I am going to be
Sunday
there.
Service.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that. And my girls' school, Beacon Hill Classical Academy, is in Camarillo, so I'm well acquainted with your community, and looking forward to joining you guys in early February.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. So.
Good, thank you.
Well, listen, the reason I'm calling is my wife and I have a daughter who is living the homosexual lifestyle, mm-hmm. and she's been that way for probably about 8 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
She's told us that she plans to get married,
mm-hmm.
and so your earlier conversation triggered something you had said. I missed the beginning of your radio show,
uh-huh.
and I wanted to hear what your thoughts were about
okay.
this as to us attending. And she's not a professing believer. She's,
right.
So
what's my view on this?
Yeah, I thought you might have. I mean, we've been struggling with this,
yeah.
thinking we don't want to burn a bridge.
No, I understand. There are going to be more difficult decisions like this that Christians are going to have to make, given the changing ethic in the culture. And here's the approach that we've taken to this. And I'm also benefiting from Alan Schliemann's approach or his perspective, his advice. Alan is our kind of resident expert on this issue. He has his brother-in-law is gay, and he has other members of his family that are homosexual, and so he knows this not just academically but firsthand. Okay,
yeah.
And let me ask you this question. It'll help put it in perspective for you. Well, just generally speaking, and I know you're a parent here, and this changes the dynamic a little bit. But just generally speaking, what are the reasons that any person goes to a wedding?
Well, to celebrate a relationship that's
yes.
going to last their life.
I agree. It's to celebrate the union, the relationship mm-hmm. that is being, in a certain sense, solemnized
right.
At the wedding. Now, is this the kind of relationship that you can actually celebrate?
No.
No, well, yeah, it was a rhetorical question. I'm pretty
yeah.
clear on the answer, but I'm just laying it out
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
If it is not the kind of relationship that you can celebrate, then why, how do mm-hmm. we justify going to an event that celebrates the relationship?
Yeah,
that's the basic calculus here for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, when it comes to the day to day living and everything after the event is over with, maybe some other considerations apply. But
mm-hmm.
I think that is a good guideline regarding a wedding service. Okay,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a hard one to employ, especially if you are a parent, because your absence is going to be conspicuous.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll tell you what Alan said, Alan Schliemann. He said once, when he faced this issue once with somebody he was close to, he thought, well, I could make a statement and maybe burn a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could just go to the ceremony in my heart, not celebrating it, but being there to establish and build the relationship. And hopefully then that will be a pretext for ongoing interaction that could have a salutary effect spiritually or whatever
right.
in the future. So he went. And what he said, and I think he showed this on the air, he said that he wished he hadn't gone. As he looks back on it now, really, nothing good came out of that. Now, he wasn't the parent of the bride,
mm-hmm.
but he said nothing really good came out of it. And
mm-hmm.
he felt a little bit like he compromised his own conscience. So in the future, he wasn't going to do this. Now, I do think it is more difficult for you because you and your wife are the parents of the bride. But I will say this, and this is also someone very, very close. I can't speak with names here right now for the sake of privacy, but there's very, very close to our organization, a very mature Christian, and a Christian worker, in fact, whose daughter has largely, for all intents and purposes, left the faith. She's 20 or 21 now. She's an adult, but for the last few years has been really rebelling and has taken up with a non-Christian guy and has moved in with them and is planning a wedding for May. Now, she is a professing Christian. He is not a Christian. This is a wrong situation, just as wrong as two women being married, two lesbians being joined in a union. They are not going to the wedding. He is the one that's supposed to walk his daughter down the aisle, and she's not lesbian. She's a heterosexual. But it is still a union that is not honorable. Right. It's also not wise. Even if this young man did know the Lord, this would be problematic for other reasons. But bare minimum, they cannot participate in this celebration. Now, once they're married, that changes things. Okay, well, one couple is married, then they start having kids. You want to strengthen that relationship, even if it didn't start out right. When it comes to a lesbian circumstance, again, this is a little bit more touch and go because that can never be made right. But distancing yourself after a ceremony like that may just appear to be mean-spirited. And so since she is your daughter, including the couple in your family life would probably be appropriate.
Right.
But you can see the difference.
Let me throw a curveball, though, because my wife wants to go to the wedding. Mm-hmm. I expressed my discomfort of this. And she feels this discomfort as well, but she still wants to go.
Yeah.
So how would you suggest we ferret through this?
I
mean, that's a whole other can of worms.
I know it is. You're not of the same mind on this, and I can understand why. I think on balance, men and women approach these kinds of questions a little differently. And so I'm not trying to make a gross generalization here, but I think I can see how, I can understand how she would want to do that, okay, and that would have a certain kind of additional or more forceful appeal then for you. Now the question is, well, let me ask you this. Who's decision, and I'm not presuming anything here at all, but I'm just whose decision in your family, how does a difference of opinion get resolved? Do you, when a big issue like this, do you break the tie? Or does she break the tie, or how does that work? And again, no judgment here. I'm just curious about.
I can't say that we have a consistent, procedure for tie breaking. What was likely to happen is Drew, she would go, and I would stay behind.
Oh boy, that's hard.
I know.
Well, that certainly is an option, and it depends on the strength of your own conviction about this issue, you may want to say, honey, before the Lord, I feel I would be doing something wrong if I did this. You seem to have a different conviction about this, and I respect that. I'm not going to order you to do differently, because that itself, may not work out well, if she does have the view, if your wife has the view, honey, I have a different view than you have, but I will respect your leadership and willingly abide by what you think is best since you're the head of the household. Well, under those circumstances, with that attitude, then you would decide what's best and you'd both abide by it. I'm not trying to trump with spirituality here. I mean, the reality of relationships is different from the ideal. I understand that. And if that's not her attitude, then trying to force the issue is going to create more difficulty in an already awkward difficult circumstance. So mm-hmm. then you have to decide if she's committed to going regardless of what you say, then you have to decide whether I go along with her or whether I stay, and that's all going to be on your based on yeah. your conscience on the issue.
Yeah, right.
But if you decide to stay, you have to be very careful that you don't in any sense kind of lord it over in a superiority kind of way over mm-hmm. your wife, because that's not going to be good for your relationship.
Yeah, I hear you. Related to this, have you heard Rosaria Butterfield speak? We've learned about her and have watched her.
No, I don't know who that is.
You know who it is? Okay, well, she's a ex-lesbian. She was a tenured professor at Syracuse in the English department. She's just incredibly articulate.
Uh-huh.
Born-again Christian who uh-huh. has left the lifestyle, and she was a major movement lesbian
uh-huh.
in back east. So she's just look her up. She's great to...
Oh, okay, good. Does she have... What's her advice on this issue?
Well, she categorizes it as a sin like other sins, but I don't know what she'd say about marriage.
I was thinking more on the issue of the wedding, of attending.
I don't know that. She hasn't uh-huh. heard speak to that.
But, yeah, yeah.
Right, but...
Okay, well, anyway, thanks for the recommendation. What's her name again?
Rosaria
uh-huh.
Butterfield.
Rosario Butterfield.
A lot of YouTube on her,
uh-huh.
and she's an incredibly... articulate spokesperson.
Right, right. Well, that's great.
So, anyway.
Well, I hope that what I've offered here, and we got 60 mm-hmm. seconds, but I hope that what I've offered here helps you in your own difficult decision. I think there's a lot of things going here, and mm-hmm. I think the principle that a wedding is a celebration, mm-hmm. that is going to be helpful for most people under most circumstances to judge the propriety of attending.
Right.
If you're a Christian. But it's, I think your circumstance is a bit of a hybrid. And so if you were of one mind with your wife on this one, I think it would be easier.
Mm-hmm.
Since you're not of one mind, you have a little bit consideration, a different consideration. And you got to choose what hill you're going to die on, you know.
Yeah.
So this you can only do before the Lord, I think.
Thank you, Greg.
Jonathan,
I look forward to seeing you.
Yes, and please let me know. Remember, I'm the guy who called about this thing because my memory about calls and everything is not so good. So when I see you, just remind me and help me out there, all right?
Okay, great.
Okay. Appreciate it, Jonathan. See you in a few weeks.
God bless you.
All right, thank you. That's a good call. Well, that's it for this show, my friends. It's great having you on board, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and I hope that it was helpful to you. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.